I'm Brendan Byrne, in for Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Republicans have controlled the legislative and executive branches of the federal government for nearly 2 years. The midterm election gave control of the House to the Democrats, but one goal the Republicans have had is to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So what kind of shape is the Affordable Care Act in right now? Open enrollment for insurance through healthcare.gov wraps up tomorrow. How many people are signing up, and what does the insurance they're getting look like? Funding's been cut for navigators to help people get insurance. So what's been your experience of buying health insurance through healthcare.gov? Are you worried about the future of the program? Does it give you the coverage you want? We're taking your calls at 1-866-338-5252 and your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando.
And joining us from our sister station WUSF in Tampa is Julio Ochoa. He's the editor of Health News Florida. Julio, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Brendan.
Also, Cynthia Cox, she's with the Kaiser Family Foundation and joins us from Washington, D.C. Cynthia, thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you.
And in the studio with me is Ann Packham. She's a healthcare navigator here in Orlando. Welcome back to Intersection, Ann.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And we're taking your calls. Give us a ring at 1-866-338-5252. You can also give us a tweet at WMFE. Orlando, what has your experience been signing up for the ACA? Do you have any questions? Well, we've got a navigator right here in the studio that can answer them, so give us a call. That's 1-866-338-5252. Julio Ochoa, I want to start with you. There's been Republican control of three branches of government for a couple of years now with the goal of repeal and replace. What difference has that made to the status of the ACA? Is it dead or alive?
Well, it's very much alive, despite what you may hear from the president. The biggest difference is there's no longer a penalty for not signing up for health insurance. So the government-led Congress repealed the fine for being uninsured, and that takes effect January 1st. The Trump administration also allowed people to sign up for these short-term health insurance plans, and those have a lower cost, but they also don't cover as much stuff as Obamacare. So we're starting to see how these two changes are playing out in the market this year.
Are those the major headwinds facing the Affordable Care Act going into 2019, or is there some other underlying things that are slowing it down?
Yeah, those are the main things. I mean, we're probably not going to see Congress do anything to repeal or replace, you know, given that Democrats took over the House. So, yeah, just seeing, you know, how many people choose not to buy health insurance because they no longer face a penalty, or if we see a lot of healthy people go over to the short-term health insurance plans, that could drive up the premiums for people who remain on Affordable Care Act plans, because those would be sicker people who have pre-existing conditions and stuff like that. So we could see premiums increase to where they're no longer sustainable for those people.
And Julio, are you able to give us a snapshot of the numbers, the people signing up in Florida? Do we know that at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. Through week six, so this is week six of open enrollment, in 2018, we've almost had 1 million people. These numbers were released on Wednesday. So 999,000 people so far have signed up. And through week six of last year, that compares to about just over 1 million people had signed up. So we're about 22,000 people behind where we were last year. And that is pretty good compared to nationally. Nationally, they're down maybe 13% compared to last year. So in Florida, we're still seeing a robust enrollment.
I want to take a listen to Joan Alker. She's with Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. She says the Affordable Care Act helped get more parents and other adults insured.
Things were going very well until 2016, but now we have seen a turnaround nationally and in Florida where the uninsured rate is starting to go back up. And we think that is really due to efforts by the Trump administration to undermine the Affordable Care Act and a very long time spent in 2017 where Congress was trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
So Alker says cutting funding for advertising and outreach has added to confusion for people trying to understand their coverage options. Cynthia Cox, I want to turn to you. Are you seeing these kind of trends play out on the national level?
Definitely. So Julio made some great points about the mandate being repealed and short-term plans being expanded, and I think that is driving a significant part of the drop in enrollment. But the cuts to outreach are also really essential to focus on. So marketing and advertising was cut about 90% going into last year. And then the Navigator program, which is both in-person assistance and outreach to kind of get the word out about open enrollment, that program was cut by 72% this year nationally, and that's following other cuts that had already happened the previous year.
And what does that mean for premiums, Cynthia? Is that having an effect on the bottom line there?
Well, I think, we've reviewed what insurance companies are saying is driving up their premiums, and they have to justify this to state regulators all over the country, and so they have to really show their math. And so we can actually see how much of the premium cost is due to these kind of political or policy changes. And based on an average of what insurers are saying nationally, that has driven up premiums by about 6 percentage points this year in 2019. Now, in some cases, premiums are still dropping because of other factors, but they would have been dropping by another 6% if it wasn't for the repeal of the mandate, the expansion of short-term plans, and the cuts to outreach.
Gotcha. Ann Packham, I'm going to bring you in now. You're a navigator here in Orlando, and I'm hearing from both Julio and Cynthia that these cuts are affecting the ground game here. Can you explain?
Definitely. So, our program was impacted by a more than 70% cut in funding, as were the statewide navigators. So the short-term implications were that this year we didn't have any funding to do outreach at all. So we didn't do any of the on-the-ground outreach that we normally would have done in September, October, leading up to open enrollment. That was an immediate effect. And then once the open enrollment is finished, most of the navigators that work on my team will not have jobs anymore. So we won't be able to do the follow-up with our clients, which is really crucial to keeping insurance, because one thing is to get enrolled, but there's often a requirement from the government that people send in income documentation or immigration paperwork. And if they don't understand the deadlines for those requirements or how to send it in or where to send it in, a navigator can really help them to keep their coverage going. So that's going to be definitely affected.
Because life events don't follow the government schedule of December 15th, right?
Right. Definitely that. And we were talking that just before we started the interview that, different enrollment periods for different employers come different times of the year. So some people may be losing coverage in the middle of the year and have to go to the marketplace to keep coverage. Other people gain coverage and have to know how to get off of their marketplace coverage. So a navigator would help them basically navigate that system so they don't wind up covered double or have no coverage at all.
Mm-hmm. So with these cuts, you won't have that staff in your office. Right?
Exactly.
Well, we're going to go to the phone lines now. You can call in with your questions. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. We're going to go to Lee now. He has a question for Ann about navigating. Lee, you are on the line. Are you there, Lee? All right. Looks like we don't have Lee there. We're going to go ahead and go to Steve. We're going to actually figure that out. Steve, Steve, you should be on the air right now. Steve? All right, looks like we don't have our phone lines right now. You can go ahead and tweet us instead at WMFE Orlando. Cynthia Cox, kind of tell me what's happening on the national level with these cuts to navigators. Are you seeing the same problems that might happen with Ann here in Orlando, that there's not going to be people that will help navigate through these changes after open enrollment or into the special enrollment period?
Yeah, definitely. We're seeing this play out across just about every state that uses healthcare.gov. And so Florida is certainly not alone. In fact, there are some states where there are just no navigator programs at all in the entire state. And, this is really key because as we heard from Ann, the navigator not only plays a role during the open enrollment period, but can also help throughout the year. And navigators are meant to be an alternative to insurance brokers. Insurance brokers can help you sign up for private insurance, but generally speaking, they're not going to help you with Medicaid. They're much less likely to help people who need language translation services or who are, immigrants. And so the Navigator programs are meant to really target low-income people, people who need additional assistance and need someone to sit down with them for an extended period of time and help them figure out not only which plan to get, but all kinds of paperwork that they're going to need to submit to get the subsidies.
So what happens in the short term then? Cynthia, is there a plan in place, or is just there will be no help?
In some places, there will just be no help. There are volunteer organizations. So in some cases, a church or other kind of organization will still have volunteers who can help people sign up. But the volunteers, in some cases, are not going to be as specially trained as navigators are. So they might not be able to help with as many detailed questions about this plan versus that plan, or, also kind of the paperwork that gets involved. So people can still call the healthcare.gov call-in number. You don't just have to rely on the website. So that is another option to try to get help, but the phone lines have been packed a lot in the last couple of days. I would encourage anyone who has not yet signed up or looked for insurance, you can at least call the helpline, and they will put you in a queue, and even if you aren't able to sign up by the Saturday deadline, it will give you at least a few extra days to, like, once you've initiated contact, you can still come back. And I will look up that phone number to give you in just a moment, too.
I don't think Anne has it, too. We'll get it by the end of the show here. Thank you, though.
Yeah.
Julio, I want to go back to you, and I want to talk a little bit about the options that are out there, because, as we mentioned, you still have some time to sign up. What are the premiums for health insurance on healthcare.gov here in Florida, and how have they changed this year compared to the big hikes last year?
Right. So last year, the big hike you're talking about was like a 45% increase last year, and that happened when the Trump administration ended subsidies to lower out-of-pocket costs for low-income Americans. So insurers responded by jacking up premiums, and then a different type of subsidy kicked in to cover those premiums. So many people didn't see if they got premiums subsidies to help with their premiums, they didn't see their premiums increase too much. This year, premiums in many parts of the country went down, and in Florida, they only increased by an average of 5%. For example, Florida Blue, the state's largest insurer, increased premiums by only 0.5%. And that's after years of double-digit increases, of course, the 45% increase that we saw last year. So we were starting to see these premiums trend, at least flatten out or maybe trend downwards, which was good news. But we'll see if that can carry on into 2019.
Julio, if people are behind in signing up or missed the Saturday deadline, I mean, we talked a little bit about it with Cynthia and Ann, but are there fail-safes in place to help those people get coverage?
Right. So, I mean, unless you qualify for one of these special enrollment periods, you're kind of out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
To qualify for a special enrollment period, like Ann said, if you lose coverage through your employer, you get fired or laid off or something like that, that's a way to qualify. If you get married and change coverage, if you have a child, something like a major life event. These are some of the only ways you can qualify.
Mm-hmm.
But like Cynthia said, if you start the process and get in with them and they have they understand that you're trying to get health insurance, they may give you a couple extra days, but you have to start the process by tomorrow.
So the message I'm hearing from all three of the guests is if you haven't done it, today's the day to get in and go ahead and do it. I'm going to try to get to the phones again. You have to apologize, or I apologize. I'm no Matthew Petty in here. Let's see if we have Lee on the line now. Lee, are you there? Looks like we don't have our phones anymore. I'm going to go ahead and take a question from Twitter now. Nicole writes, how does someone become certified as a navigator to help volunteer during special enrollment? Anne, I'm going to kick that to you.
All right. So to become a navigator, you have to be a recipient of one of the navigator grants. So you would have had to have done that already. And this year, navigators who had previously been certified were allowed to move to the volunteer status if they chose to. So you have to have already been certified in the past. There are other community organizations, as I think Cynthia mentioned, that have certified application counselors, and a nonprofit can apply to become a CAC organization. Obviously, it's too late for this year's open enrollment, but that would be a possibility for next year.
Gotcha. And what's been the response when the navigators first came online, when this was rolled out? I mean, have you seen an increase in navigators throughout the program, and then the drop off with the funding cuts, or how's it been?
Definitely. So, I mean, obviously the first year, you know, in 2013, we were all getting organized and we were all getting certified. The website was clunky. But as the years have gone on, we have done a lot of outreach and found many people in the community who need our help. So this year, for example, we had no trouble at all filling our schedules completely with appointments. And as I mentioned, though, unfortunately, there are many counties in Florida that do not have a navigator at all, a physical presence. So they have to do the enrollment through what I call a virtual enrollment. So someone's looking at the computer screen and doing with that person. And in our case here in Orlando, as I mentioned, most of the navigators will not be working after tomorrow because of the funding cuts.
Mm-hmm. What is the process like? Has the process gotten easier over the years? Has it gotten more challenging? Kind of walk me through what it's like to sign up.
It's not as difficult as people make it out to be. The difficulty comes for a lot of people in estimating what their income will be. If they're self-employed or they have two or three different jobs, they're not sure if they put their gross income or they put their profit or their net. Trying to figure out exactly what qualifies there to get the subsidies is probably the hardest thing for people to do. It can be a really quick process. I did an enrollment yesterday. A walk-in came in, a young person, relatively uncomplicated application, and we were done in 45 minutes. And she had chosen a plan. We had talked about which doctor she would go to, and it was very quick. So it can be relatively quick and painless. Especially if you're working with somebody who does, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 applications a day,
mm-hmm.
it shouldn't be that hard. But a lot of people will think that they can do it on their own. They submit the application, don't get the results that they expected, and then they're calling us to try to figure out what did I do wrong. Or they get to the plan selection phase and they're overwhelmed because there are a lot of choices. Here in Orlando, in this 4-county area, we got a new plan this year. So there are more choices than there were last year, and people have to sort through, is that a good option? Should I change? Do I have to change my primary care doctor if I switch over to that one? What does this deductible mean versus this deductible? So it can be more complicated than people think than just kind of going on and just choosing the first one that comes up on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Julio Ochoa, is that what you're hearing from Floridians throughout your reporting, that there's information overload and too many plans on the market?
Well, I mean, if you can just imagine, if you have a doctor and you're seeing somebody and you want to make sure that your plan covers that, you know, and you're trying to figure out, like, looking at all these plans online, it can get confusing. I mean, just signing up through your employer can be a little confusing sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I can only imagine. And that's what these navigators like Ann are there to do, is kind of help walk you through the process and make it easier. And, you know, I know that they see record volume throughout these final days of enrollment, just from people calling and trying to figure out the process. So I'm wondering if Ann has seen a whole lot of volume in these past few days.
Oh, definitely. I mean, our phones are ringing off the hook. At this point, we don't have any more open slots. However, you know, if we get a cancellation, we try to squeeze somebody in. But at this point, we are encouraging what Cynthia says, we call the national number and make sure you get into the queue so that you're allowed to enroll after Saturday if you can't get it done. And then, of course, the navigator, some of us will be available, you know, after Saturday if you're still trying to pick a plan at that point.
Do we have that national number, Ann?
Yes, it's 800-318-2596.
And we'll put that on our website at WMFE.org after this show here. And kind of tell me, I've got a question here from Lee, who we've tried to get on the line. Lee, I apologize, we couldn't get you through our phone system here. Lee asks, what happens if you make too much money for subsidies but too little for Medicaid?
Well, if you make too much money for subsidies, that means that you earn over 400% of the federal poverty level. And in that case, your option is to purchase a marketplace plan without a subsidy. If you make less than 100% of the federal poverty level, you would only qualify for Medicaid in the state of Florida if you're pregnant, if you have young children and very, very low income, or you're disabled. In that case, you're in what we know here as the Medicaid gap. And your best option then is to use the resources that we have through our federally qualified health centers. We are lucky here in Central Florida in particular to have several of them. You would go there and seek care there. And there are people there that can help you try to figure out maybe once you're in the Medicaid gap, you're not always in the Medicaid gap. I talk to a lot of people who currently right now maybe have a part-time job. They're looking. They've just graduated. But in 2 or 3, 4 months, you get a job and you have enough income to qualify. You can get a special enrollment period that we affectionately call coming out of the Medicaid gap. And a navigator can help you through that process. Or you can call the federal call center and explain to them, hey, I'm not in the Medicaid gap anymore. I'm now working and I should qualify for a subsidy.
Healthcare is complex business. I mean, it shows why that there are navigators out there. Right?
I mean, it seems strange that our ability to get healthcare is so much either tied to our employment or our income taxes. It's just, mm-hmm. It's not like that in any place else in the world.
Mm-hmm. We've got another question from the phone lines that unfortunately we couldn't get through. This one is, why are they cutting funding for navigators? And Cynthia Cox, I want to pitch that to you. Why was there this cut?
That's a very good question. It was a decision by the Trump administration, and to be honest, it seemed to be politically motivated as one of the several ways in which the Trump administration has tried to kind of chip away at the Affordable Care Act because they were not able to repeal the ACA in Congress, and so the Trump administration has tried to make various different changes that are within their domain to cut funding in various places or to issue new regulations that would weaken the Affordable Care Act's marketplaces. Just because we're running out of time, I did want to squeeze in one fact, because Anne made a very important point that just because you've been told you don't need or you don't qualify for help at one point in your life doesn't mean that you might not now qualify for help. So we did a study where we found that about a third of the people in Florida who are uninsured right now actually qualify for a $0, a free bronze plan. And so they may have been told before that they're not eligible for help, but now they are. That might be part of the reason, or they might just not know that this is available to them. But there are almost 600,000 people in Florida who are uninsured now but could be getting free coverage.
And Cynthia, that $0 cost, you mean?
Yeah, so the $0 premium, you would still potentially face costs when you go to the doctor. There are preventive services are free. Your doctor's visits might be, say, $35 before your deductible for at least a few of those visits. If you have a hospitalization, that's where it gets expensive. But if you're having a hospitalization when you're uninsured, that could mean that you're just in debt for the rest of your life or that you even lose your house. But if you're insured, you're limited in how much debt you can take on. So you would take on no more than about $7,000. And frankly, it's a lot easier to raise $7,000 on GoFundMe than it is to raise $200,000.
Well, Cynthia, what about celebrity endorsements and celebrity calls to action? I know former President Obama put out a video earlier this year. There was an uptick in enrollment there. Has that been helping? Has that been filling the gap of that marketing budget that was cut?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think it's kind of ironic, but I think a lot of the news coverage that was happening around ACA repeal last year was also kind of motivating celebrities and other kind of high-profile people, whether on TV shows or on social media, to try to kind of get the word out about ACA enrollment. So we saw a lot of that last year, and I haven't been seeing as much of that this year. I think the energy from people who support the ACA may have been more focused on the midterm elections or other things going on, and so I just haven't seen as many people kind of trying to get out the enrollment news as much. And so, but there has been a bit more just in the last few days. Former President Obama made a video. I've seen Stephen Colbert tweet about it. So there are people who are trying to kind of get the word out about enrollment, but there's only a couple days left, so it may not be enough to make up for the lack of coverage earlier.
Well, healthcare is complex. That's why we have folks like Cynthia Cox with the Kaiser Family Foundation in Washington, D.C., trying to make it a little clearer for us. Thank you for joining us, Cynthia.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Julio Ochoa. He's the editor of Health News Florida at WUSF in Tampa. Julio, thanks for your insight.
My pleasure, Brendan.
And here in the studio, Ann Packham. She's a healthcare navigator here in Orlando. Ann, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, still to come, we remember James Wilson, better known as Chief, who died last week at the age of 90. He was the director of the Jones High School Band from 1950 to 1990. Intersection returns in a minute.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A funeral service will be held in Orlando this morning for James W. Chief Wilson, who died last week at the age of 90. Wilson was the director of the Jones High School Band from 1950 to 1990. Starting with hand-me-down instruments and uniforms, Wilson took the band to the national stage, including a performance at the World's Fair in New York in 1964. One of the band members at that performance was a young Carl Maltsby. Well, Carl Maltsby, thank you for joining us.
Oh, Matt, thank you for having me here.
So the passing of James W. Chief Wilson is a big deal in the musical community in Orlando, and especially for Jones High School. Tell me a little bit about how you knew James Chief Wilson.
Well, first of all, let me just say it is a big deal in the Orlando community because Chief, as we affectionately called him, stretched beyond the confines of the high school, especially after he retired and had a lot more time. I can't remember when I first became aware of Chief, because Chief came to Orlando in 1950 and I was a toddler. I certainly knew who he was because we lived at the corner of Paramore and Long, and that was always a parade route in the black community. And the apartment that we had a porch, and we would see the parades going by, and that was when I first became aware of Chief.
Mm-hmm.
And then my stepbrother, Horace Holliday, joined the band as a drummer. So that made Chief a little bit closer. And when I was in fifth grade at Holden Street Elementary School, Chief came out to introduce us to the flutophone and teach us music via the flutophone. And the following year, I was in sixth grade, my classmate Eric Waldhauer had already made the band in fifth grade and was going to rehearsals after school. So I joined him and I started going to rehearsal. So I've known Chief since 1957. He's been a major fixture in my life.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that when he started teaching at Jones High School, they didn't even have a music department. So he had to build that thing from scratch.
He had to build it from scratch. In fact, Chief said in an interview in 2010 that his proudest moment was when Curtis Ram, a local tenor who had come through Jones High School, substituted for Pavarotti. And for Chief, that was just such an honor that the music department that he had helped to craft,
mm-hmm.
even though this particular person came through the choral music department, but the choral music teacher, Edna Sampson Hogrett, who was Curtis's teacher, had been one of Chief's band students. and that Curtis had come through this Jones High School department that Chief had created, and that was his really proudest moment, that he could have a student to achieve to international fame on the opera stage.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your strongest or fondest memories of Chief?
Well, I could say my strongest memory of Chief is after I left high school. Every 10 years, as I hit a new decade in my life, Chief would have a sit-down conversation with me and tell me what I needed to expect in life moving through the next decade and how I should be willing to accept and adjust changes in the the body, the mind, all these sort of things, the guidance.
Mm-hmm.
He gave three life lessons that, well, maybe four, that really stick with me. In his teaching, he wanted us to be more than musicians. He wanted us to know how to navigate life, that four-letter word. And the first thing he said, to every task, you bring a positive attitude. Secondly, he said, you can change your ways, but you can't change your habits, which led to the third one, which is perfect practice makes perfect.
So he was kind of taking those lessons that you would apply to the teaching of music and being in a band and broadening them out and saying, these are rules for life. These are lessons for life.
Right. Mm. And the fourth lesson is the one that we are going through now. Back in 2002, 2003, within a period of like 10 months, I lost my Aunt Ida, who was very important in taking me to music lessons and so forth, my Uncle Lewis in New York, and my mother. And Chief said to me, everyone in life has his turn to go through this. It's just now your turn. And that is what has sustained me in the last few days, thinking of those words. It's just my turn. It is part of life.
Now, you've got a record there with you.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that record.
Okay. This is our pride and joy. It's called Jones High School Symphonic Band, Orlando, Florida, James W. Wilson Band Director. This is actually the archive copy, so it has never. This particular copy has not been opened.
Mm.
But what Chief was most proud of on this recording is our playing of the Symphony No. 9 from the New World by Antonin Dvorak. Jones High School Symphonic Band was the first band, black or white, in the state of Florida to play an entire symphony. And he was most proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
It also has on here other selections that we played at the New York World's Fair. Because this concert, in fact, it was a concert that the record was made from,
mm-hmm.
was an appreciation concert to the Orlando community for sending the Jones High School Band to perform at the New York World's Fair of 1964.
And actually, there's a photograph on the back, right?
There is a photograph on the back of the band standing in front of Unisphere, which was the symbol and still remains out there of the World's Fair. Still is out there in Queens, in Forest Hill.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the last time I went to the U.S. Open, I made sure I took a picture mm-hmm. in front of Unisphere because that has played such an important role in my life. And that's all thanks to Chief Wilson.
Cal Maltzby, whereabouts are you in this photograph?
Oh, where am I on this photograph? I am 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 person in holding a clarinet between Donald Jones and Nathaniel Evans.
Wow, so the young Cal Maltzby was a clarinet player.
Young Carl Maltzby was a clarinet player, and thanks to Chief, I was a woodwindist. Because through Chief's innovation and interactions with Yves Chardon, mm-hmm. who was the conductor of the Florida Symphony Orchestra. Yves Chardon detested the notion of segregation,
mm-hmm.
where black folk could not come to the municipal auditorium, as it was called then. It's now known as the Bob Carr Auditorium. Yves detested the fact that black folk could not come to the auditorium. So he brought the Florida Symphony Orchestra to Jones. That's mm-hmm. something that he and Chief worked out, and subsequently, Chief went about spearheading the integration of the Florida Symphony Youth Orchestra. A young man who was a baritone horn player in the band played cello as a result of Chief's guidance. Mm-hmm. And Eddie Seaman became the first black to play in the Florida Symphony Youth Orchestra, which is still going on today.
What do you think his greatest legacy is?
Well, clearly, his greatest legacy is embodied in the Jones High School band. But I think the legacy is those intangible gifts that he passed on to his students and those people that he came in contact with. One of the reasons that Chief was so popular and the Jones band was so popular, I maintain, is that in the parades, we would always play a patriotic march. It eventually became that when we did a parade, we would play the Caissons Go Rolling Along, which is the Army. We would play the It Took the Blue from the Sky to the Pretty Girl's Eye, the Air Force theme. Mm-hmm. We would play Anchors Away, the Navy. And I think at one point in time, we even wound up adding the Coast Guard theme in there. So all those very patriotic pieces were a part of the Jones High School marching repertoire. And I think that's what endeared him to a lot of the people in the greater Orlando area. And not to mention, he crafted a very good, solid instrument. The Jones High School band was good. Mm-hmm. In fact, how we got to the World's Fair was that the secretary, or the receptionist, I can't remember exactly what her title, for L.A. Johnson Fuel Oil had read in the Orlando Sentinel that Edgewater High School was being sent to the World's Fair. And she wrote a letter asking the question, why isn't Jones being sent to the World's Fair? Because everyone in Orlando knew that Jones was the best band. Mm-hmm. And from that point, the city and Orlando Sentinel got together and they got behind raising the funds to send both Jones and Edgewater to the 1964 World's Fair.
We've been speaking with Carl Maltzby about James W. Chief Wilson, the former Jones High School band director. Carl, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
And to play us out, that 1964 recording of the Jones High School Band performing Antonin Dvorak's New World Symphony, featuring a clarinet solo by Carl Maltzby. Up next, music from Violectric. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Violectric go by the label Classic Musicians Who Rock. They've been rehearsing for their 6th annual holiday show at the Lake Eola Walt Disney Amphitheatre in downtown Orlando this evening. Violectric join us in the studio now with a mashup of Sweet Dreams and Hanukkah, O Hanukkah. Thank you. Michelle Jones, Lexi Parsons, Chrissy Franzen, and Paul Cuevas via Electric. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Michelle, I want to start with you. You are the band leader of this group. You've been around for some time now. Tell me a little bit about what you've been doing.
Well, my goodness, I've been in Orlando for over 25 years, so this is definitely home. And with that, I created Via Electric. In fact, we're celebrating 10 years this month. Mm-hmm. So it's been around for 10 years. And although we've had some changes in personnel over the years as people come in and move on and go to other wonderful, exciting things, we have been around and we're delighted that Orlando is our home and that you have welcomed us so much. So thank you for that. In the past 10 years, we've done everything from performing on MTV to... We're still played regularly on Sirius XM satellite radio. We love that PBS still broadcasts one of our television specials that we did, on, especially the feature on our education programs. And just delighted that everything has happened and it's just continuing to grow and get bigger. And next year we'll be headlining the Twisted Strings Music Festival down in Fort Myers as one of the grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. So we're thrilled about that.
What is Twisted Strings?
Twisted Strings is a festival that really focuses on string instruments being played in non-traditional ways. So I think that fits right in line with the vision of Via Electric because that's what we do. We mm-hmm. take popular music and modern music and we put our twist on it. And that's why we call ourselves classic musicians who rock.
Well, Lexi Parsons, let me move to you. What was your path to this group? You sort of came through kind of classical, orchestral training, that sort of thing?
I actually had a little bit of a different background. I mostly started out with the public school system, which that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Moved on to some classical training, primarily did fiddle up until I went to college at Stetson University.
This is like Irish music?
Yep, a lot of Irish.
Yeah.
Yep. And then once I was at Stetson, it was pretty much fully classical for my undergrad music performance.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I was working at Atlantic Strings Violin Shop, and Michelle was one of our customers who would come in, and she asked me about it one day, and I joined the group.
How's it been?
It's been a lot of fun. It's been fabulous.
Do you find yourself drawing more on your classical training or more on your folk music training for Via Electric?
It's a nice combination of both. It mm-hmm. helps to have the technique to do some of the more advanced passages, but then if you can rock it out a little bit, that definitely helps. It's not something you get with classical.
Chrissy Franzen, what do you enjoy playing? Are you straight down the line classical? Do you enjoy adapting rock music to the cello?
I love anything non-traditional. So, like, I grew up with Frank Zappa and all of that kind of, like, influential, experimental. So when I met Michelle, it was just so much fun to jump into something that you could actually enjoy while you were playing.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a stuffy sitting up and you had to dress in your best. It was going to the people playing really fun music, getting to, like, dance and move around and have personality and spunk.
What's been your favorite experience with Via Electric so far?
Oh, man, honestly, I mean, the performances are so much fun. But sitting in Michelle's office and playing and doing things like this where you get to meet tons of new people and just new experiences, it's really been wonderful.
How do you come up with the ideas? Like, what's the sort of song creation process? Because sometimes you're like doing a cover of something, you might do something original. How does that all work?
Well, honestly, I think I'm going to throw this over here because Paul does all the arranging.
The selection process is actually more of Michelle's domain. So, she just tells me what to do, and I do it. I'm the lap. Well, not the lap dog. I am the shepherd dog of the team, man.
Honestly, what we do is we look to the group. We say, "Is there a song that you think would be a really good fit?" Because they've all been with us. They know our style. They know that we're looking for songs that have harmonies, but also have fun rhythms and things. So we look to the group and we take suggestions from within. And then I say, yeah, I think that'll work. Let's do that. Paul, can you come up with an arrangement for that?
And then I turn it out and make it happen.
So the songs for the concert, you've taken some classic rock and you've sort of mashed it up with classic holiday tunes.
Yes, sir.
How do you figure out which tune goes with which? Is it a matter of the timing, the beat?
Spending many hours at a piano and sitting and thinking, this has, you know, you got to think of keys and tonalities. Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of the older Christmas tunes are not in our traditional Western key system. They're more of a old-fashioned church modes. So you got to think, oh, well, this will work and this won't work. Let's try this. You know, we divvy things up, so we'll split a verse. We'll cut it in half. We'll expand it. So trying different things and just hoping something works and clicks.
Do you improvise when you perform?
Yes. Yeah. It's I would say it's kind of a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we don't want to stifle creativity, but at the same time, you know, we want people to recognize what the song is and feel free to add, sprinkle in your personality.
Tell me about the bow you're holding too, Michelle, because this is what, a laser bow?
It is. It's actually called a laser bow. And a lot of people think that it looks like a lightsaber because it is definitely lit with a 100 milliwatt laser. And no, it's not getting hot in my hands or anything because the laser is actually attached to my body and it's encased, so it's protected, so it's not burning me either. But it travels down a fiber optic cable. The light travels down a fiber optic cable, and then it is spread across this other exclusive fiber optic that is exclusive to us, and that my husband, Jerry Jones, has worked with to create and invent. So it lights up really bright, and it really does look like vroom, 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 you know, lightsaber.
and you all are often performing in situations where the lights might be dimmed, so you can kind of get that light effect.
Sometimes we ask that the lights actually be dimmed a little bit so that you can get a fuller effect, absolutely. We pair this up with our instruments, which also were created by Jerry Jones. And they are LED DMX programmable and controllable, which means if you have a stage show, obviously you have a lighting designer who's developed this really cool lighting effect for the stage. They control our instruments because each instrument is individually programmable and addressable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's we're part of the stage show. The stage show is part of us. And it's just something you can't get anywhere else because no one in the world has developed that technology except Jerry Jones.
So tell me a little bit about the concert.
Our holiday concert is tonight at 7 p.m. at Lake Eola at the amphitheater there, the Walt Disney Amphitheater. It is presented by the City of Orlando Department of Parks, Recreation, and Families. Hope I got the name right. And we also like to partner with a charity for this. So this year we have chosen Pet Alliance of Greater Orlando as our preferred charity. And we are asking people to bring a blanket to sit on. Because, yes, there are chairs, but those metal chairs get really cold. So bring a blanket or a towel to sit on. And then afterwards, donate that towel or blanket to the Pet Alliance of Greater Orlando. And, of course, they always welcome cash donations. And I understand their most urgent need right now is wet cat food. So if anyone can bring some wet cat food to Lake Eola on December 14th, we'd really appreciate that, too. We'll also have Santa and Mrs. Claus, who will be there to take pet photos or human photos if you want, so you get a chance to meet with them. We'll also have some celebrity guests, which I can't go into right now because it's going to be a surprise.
Well, Violetrica, Michelle Jones, Lexi Parsons, Chrissy Franzen, and Paul Cuevas, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Matt.
Thank you.
And to play us out, Violetric with a mashup of Heroes and The First Noel. You're listening to Violetric performing Heroes and The First Noel. Listen to a bonus track, a mashup of Centuries and Carol of the Bells, over on our website, wmfe.org. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Production assistance for this week's show from Danielle Pryor and Juan Gualda. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.